Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. Presented by Belco Credit Union. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening, folks. It's a great pleasure to welcome such a nice turnout to the Tattered Cover tonight. I'm not going to say a whole lot because we have a double treat tonight. So it's a double pleasure, as I said, to welcome Greg Schwipps with being introduced by Kent Hariff. So we have two good honors tonight, and then let's start with welcoming Kent to introduce Greg. Okay.
Thank you, Pat. Well, it's a pleasure to be here. It's a pleasure to be anywhere. But it's especially satisfying to be among people who care about books. And I'm particularly pleased to be here in the Tattered Cover Bookstore, as everyone here who knows is one of the best independent bookstores in the country. In the literary world, in New York and all over the country, everybody knows the Tattered Cover. And it's very important to me to do what I can to support independent bookstores. And here in Denver, we know and admire Joyce Meskis, not only as one of the great bookstore owners in this country, but also for her civic-mindedness. And I want to say thank you, too, to my friend Kathy Langer, who's not here tonight, but who does so much to keep this great store going, and who is such a good friend to all the writers who pass through here. Well, it is a pleasure for me to introduce Greg Schwipps tonight. He is one of the best and most likable of all the students I've taught in almost 30 years of teaching. And I also want to acknowledge his parents, Dick and Mary Lou Schwipps, with whom Kathy and I spent several enjoyable days in their farm in Indiana. And incidentally, that's my wife, Kathy, in the back row there. Dick and Mary Lou had something to do with the fact that Greg was born in 1972 in Batesville, Indiana. After that, he was raised on a farm near Milan, Indiana, famous as the little town whose high school basketball team defeated a big city team to win the state championship and about whom the movie Hoosiers was made. Greg, among other things, is an avid fisherman. And like most fishermen, he's a storyteller. This book is good proof of that. Yeah. Well, I'm trying to be kind here. He claims that he caught a 40-pound blue catfish last summer on the Ohio River. I don't have any proof of that, but I do have proof and belief that he graduated from DePauw University in Greencastle, Indiana, and he is now teaching at DePauw, where he is an associate professor in the English department, teaching everything from first-year composition to the senior seminar in writing. He's a superior teacher. I know that. I've been on that campus twice with him in his seminars, and he's won awards as a teacher at that university. I believe at least one of his students is here tonight, and she can verify what I've just said. Greg and I have known each other since the middle 1990s, He was one of the students in the graduate creative writing program at Southern Illinois University in Carbondale. And I remember that the manuscript he submitted as part of the application had to do with carp fishing. And I remember how satisfied I was in reading something that was interesting and vivid, that was so different from all the other manuscripts we got among applicants there. Greg graduated from SIUC in 1998. And while he was there, he had the great good luck to meet Alyssa Caton. And somehow he lied well enough or storied well enough to persuade her to marry him a couple years later. And Kathy and I were at the wedding in Paducah, Kentucky, where Alyssa came from. She is an editor at the publishing house in Indianapolis, which publishes the Dummy books. She's been there, going on 10 years, I believe. They now live in the woods in Indiana with their dogs. And Greg teaches, as I say, at DePauw to make a living. And all the time, when he's not fishing, he is also writing fiction and nonfiction. I have to say about writing students that most of them quit writing after they graduate because it's too difficult. I don't think there's exactly a shortage of talent in the world, but I do think when it comes to writing that there's a shortage of talent for work, for the kind of work it takes in any case. Most writing students quit before they get good enough to write something that someone wants to buy. There's too much discouragement, too much rejection. You have to be persistent. You have to believe in yourself despite all the evidence. Greg is one of the rare people who not only has talent as a writer, but he's one who also has talent for work. He has persisted, and it has paid off finally with this terrific novel, What This River Keeps. Let me just say a little about Greg's novel by repeating what I've said about it on the back cover of this book, where I wanted to publicly celebrate the skill and success of this novel and to help bring whatever readers I could to it. What This River Keeps bears comparison to the best work of Steinbeck. In this case, we're given the vivid portrayal of the common working men and women of rural Indiana, juxtaposed against great forces, without pity or hope, but without true defeat, though they may well lose all in the end. Schwipps also gives us, in full measure, the ancient father and son story reinvented and made new, the complications of family, the friendship between men, the long-tested love between married people, the discovery of the responsibilities of love, the love and care of the land, the love of a river, the keen life of the outdoors, the close attention to the earth in its seasons and myriad variousness. This is a very fine first novel. I read it compelled and fascinated to the last word. It is one of those rare books that is not only literary, but makes you want to turn pages. Please help me welcome my friend, Greg Schwipps.
I think I am a long way from home. Where I'm from in Indiana, we're not used to mountains and there are more trees. But I'm also a long way from home in that I don't usually read at the Tattered Cover. I've read at some places back home in Indiana, and at the last reading, which was in Osgood, Indiana, there were maybe 15 people there, but I knew all of them from family reunions. They were all family members. And the director of the library was very young and confused and very interested in her text that she started typing. And so she hadn't thought about introducing me, and nobody had. And so we were there. So I made my 12-year-old niece get up and introduce me. And it was a nice introduction. Instead of the Steinbeck thing, she said, "Best uncle ever." But this was a very special introduction, too, of course. And I think all of you here know Kent as a writer. And my dad said, a lot of people are probably going to come to see him instead of you. And I said, Dad, that's totally fine. But you know him as a writer and some of you as a person. I can tell you that I may be the only one in the room who has been Kent's student. And just the best, as you can imagine, all-time teacher. And if anything works here, he probably deserves credit. And if it doesn't work, all my fault. I also want to say it's good to see Kathy, Kent's wife. We haven't seen her for a while, so it's been great. My parents came all the way from Indiana. They're here, and Bruce and Perry, our other family members, are here, and friends from Osgood, and my wife is here, as he said. And I also have to thank John and Karen, who hosted us here in Denver. They've taken such good care of us. And my student Andrea is here. And I want to thank the Tattered Cover and Pat. This, when I tell my colleagues I was going to read at the Tattered Cover, they go nuts. They can't believe it. And if Matt Davis, who's also here, had not believed in this book with Ghost Road Press, then none of us would be here. So I really want to thank him publicly for believing in me. And I guess that's it. I hope to read next time. I'm sorry it took so long. And I'm going to be ready, too. I told Pat, I said, let's get one of those cool photos so you can put me right up there next to Tim O'Brien. And she kind of begged off that a little bit. So I don't know if I'm going to get that or not. But I am being podcast, first time ever. I don't even know what it is, but I think it's cool. So I waited my whole life to have a book to read from, and I put so many words in there, the font's small, and I don't know, my eyes aren't any good. I can't read it, so I have to print some things out. But what I'd like to do is read three separate parts of the book, and I'll kind of introduce them. And if anyone's left after the third section, I would like to take some questions, because as my wife will tell you, I like that sort of unscheduled or unprogrammed chatter. There are two epigraphs. The first part of this I'm going to read. I've never read out loud before, but I practiced it. But it's hard to kind of get to the gist of the book, which is that it's this eminent domain story. And so I read a part that tries to get to that, maybe a little less than some of the character development parts that I'll read a little later. But there are two epigraphs that I should read first that I think will help set the stage. And the first is from the Fifth Amendment to the Constitution. And it reads, "No person shall be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor shall private property be taken for public use without just compensation." The second epigraph is from a government brochure called Your Rights to Private Property, What to Do When the Government Wants to Acquire Your Land. And it reads, "Loss of sentimental value, of historic interest, and emotional trauma associated with having to sell property through condemnation are not compensable under the law and may not be considered." So that's kind of where the book starts, and I'm going to read something from later in the book. It's from chapter 17, and in this part, Frank, who's sort of the main character, an elderly man, is going to a diner with his friend, and his friend's name is Chubb. I didn't really think about the names as I wrote the book, and then the book got picked up, and now the names are in there. My brothers make fun of me for them, but so anyway, this is from chapter 17, and they're on their way fishing, or actually they're not, and they're in a cafe. Sorry about that. Yeah, a pretty smooth intro, wasn't it? The cafe they frequented was owned by a woman they'd known since school. Lila ran the cafe with her daughters now. It stood on an empty stretch of highway just outside of town in a building that had housed a family in its previous life. Lila's grandmother's, in fact. Customers parked in a gravel lot that had been the backyard. They found seats at a little table by the front window, and Lila herself saw them and rumbled over. "Here comes big old cow tits," Chubb whispered. Sure enough, Lila arrived. This book's pretty quietly offensive all the way through, and I forgot to say that. In different ways. Sorry, I usually warn people. Sure enough, Lila arrived and stood over them, notebook in hand and her bosom all but blocking out the overhead lighting. "Well, if it ain't my two favorite fishermen," she said too loudly. "Every time it rains, I say to the girls, look out for those two dirty catfishers, they'll be coming." "You know us too well, Lila," Chubb said. "Except today we're just eating," Frank said. "Well, they say wonders never ceased, and now I believe that one. What can I get you two gents this day?" "I want the breaded tenderloin," Chubb began. "Same as always, in other words," she said, writing it down on her little pad. "Yeah, I reckon so. Same as always. Frank wanted the fish sandwich and fries." She wrote it down. "How come you write it down if you already know what he's wanting?" Chubb asked. He didn't flirt often, but she brought out his best efforts. "Oh, you know," she said, quieter now. "Soon as I find a cook smarter than his skillet, I'll be all right. You know what I mean?" She laughed then, a hearty chest-shaking laugh. Her breast heaved. She leaned down to share a secret, and the boobs fell like giant boulders from the sky. If they'd hit the table, it would have smashed to the ground in a cloud of splintered particle board and 2x4s. The two men looked up at them as if Jesus himself were coming forth. She kept her hair dyed red and wore too much makeup for a woman in her 60s. Now she was closer, and they could smell her perfume. It was too strong for Frank, but Chubb breathed in deeply. "I'm about ready to hire me a Mexican," she whispered. "A what?" Chubb asked. a meskin to cook. She looked at Chub, but he was politely staring at the top of her shirt where the mounds of her breasts were visible and white. "You're going to hire a Mexican in here?" Frank asked. "Oh, yeah," she said, glancing back and forth at both of them. "I've been hearing about them and their work habits. A Mexican will work for nothing and never miss a day. That old boy I got back there now is white, but he's so screwed up with his liquor, he's about half-cocked when he gets here." Her breasts retook the rightful place above them. "I'll have this food right out to you, sweethearts, and two coffees like you like it." After she left, they looked at each other and chuckled. "Remind me to ask about the help next time," Chubb said. The restaurant was halfway crowded for once, and they watched people come in and sit down, mostly working men, a construction crew clearing out under power lines. Lila made her rounds, laughing and talking. She brought waters, and they held the cool glasses in their worn hands. Chubb took a drink of his water and nodded. He stared at the red plastic glass. There was something crusted near the lip, and he chipped it off with his thumbnail. He looked up as a young man in khakis and a collared shirt walked in and sat down at the table next to theirs. Lila came to take his order. "What can I get you, mister?" they heard her say. "Well," the young man said, "I'm afraid I'll need a few moments. I've never eaten here before." "You haven't? I didn't think I'd seen you here before. Well, welcome to Lila's, and that'd be me. Who are you, and what in the world brings you to these parts?" Steve Dunkirk, and work, actually. I'm the project manager for the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. So I'm here to study. "Army? You don't look like no five-star general." She laughed good-naturedly in his face. Frank turned in his seat to see and hear better. The young man was blushing now, explaining that civilians could work in the Army Corps of Engineers. "Don't worry, honey," she interrupted him. "I aim to serve all branches of the military. You sit here and think about what you want to eat and then holler at me, okay?" She snapped off a salute and went into the kitchen through a swinging door at the back of the room. Steve looked at them. "What's good here, fellas?" "The tenderloin's awful good," Chubb said. "It is. I believe I'll try that then." "What was it you said you were here for?" Frank asked. He watched as Steve's eyes surveyed the room before speaking. "Well, I work for the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers," he began, "and I'm managing the project we've begun feasibility studies on." "And what project is that?" The 20 other customers in the room were involved in their own lives and meals. Steve glanced at them before answering. "Well, I'm primarily concerned with flood control, that and municipal use, which means things like drinking water. This project is slated to become a state recreational area, providing boating and fishing access as well. Fish stocking would be managed by your state DNR. Lila appeared then with their food, Chubb's tenderloin hanging out over the bun, almost as big as the plate itself. She put the platters down along with two cups of coffee steaming. "Here you go, fellas," she said. "Can I get you anything else?" "Ketchup," Chubb said. "It's already there," Lila said in her loud voice, pointing down. "Oh, I see it," he said. "I guess it got lost in the shadows." He winked up at her. "And now you're probably ready to order," she said to Steve. "And by the way, you don't want to get too involved with my catfishers here. They're bad news bears." "I believe I'll have the tenderloin as per this man's request," Steve said, "and a Coke with that." Lila looked at him funny before writing it down and returning to the kitchen. Chubb tore open three sugar packets from the dish on the table and poured them into his coffee. He tipped the ketchup over his fries and tenderloin. Frank was still looking at Steve. "So what project was that again?" "Well, you've probably heard of it, but I'm here to help determine the feasibility of the project." "Where, though?" Steve met his stare. "The one involving a section of Big Log Jam River outside of the town, also named Log Jam. Near here, also in Shipley County." "I thought so, you sons of bitches." Chubb stopped eating and looked from Frank to Steve, who had lifted his hands, palms out. "Now hold on," Steve said. "There's a process we follow, and we ascertain where we can do what we need to do with a minimum of contingencies. And any affected landowners are compensated fairly after public meetings, which allow for..." "I want to ask you something, mister, since you're supposed to know. These people along here who are out to lose everything, what happens to them, their houses?" "Well, we certainly hope many people aren't affected." Frank rolled his eyes, and so Steve sped up. "But those who are will have their property appraised, and they'll be compensated. But we also have real estate people who help landowners relocate, buying comparable property nearby, where applicable. You'll buy it, in other words." "Well, not me exactly, but the federal government, yes. And what if the landowners don't sell?" Sir, we intend to have public meetings for this sort of debate. What's wrong with us talking a little right here?" Steve looked around. Some of the men had stopped eating and were watching. "Well, the government does have the right of eminent domain," he said quickly. "You'll take it then?" Now, again, this isn't really me we're talking about here. I work out of the Louisville District Office, but ultimately I work for Colonel Haverstick of the U.S. Army. But Frank had heard enough. He grabbed his cane and started to walk out before he remembered Lila, and he stopped and drew a 20 out of his wallet and tossed it on the table. Chubb stood up in a hurry and knocked his chair over. He righted and grabbed both sandwiches from their plates before following Frank out the door. They heard Lila come out of the kitchen calling after them, but they went on. Out in the parking lot, a white sedan with mud splashed on the sides sat next to Frank's truck. The door of the car bore a placard that read, U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. Frank spat on it before he climbed into his truck. It had stopped raining, but the car was still wet, and the white spit bled into the raindrops. So that's the first section I'd like to read, and the two main characters really are Frank and Ethel, the elderly couple who are going to lose their farm. But the book's also about their estranged son, and who's named Ollie. And it's about Ollie and his friend Coondog. And Ollie gets in a relationship with a woman. And this is sort of the very beginning of that relationship. I tell people when my younger, they say, that Ollie, a lot of people don't like Ollie, and I tell them when my younger brother's not here that this is based on my younger brother. He loves that. So in this section, this is from earlier in the book, and Ollie and his friend Coondog have entered a demolition derby in a county fair in Indiana, and it has just ended, and it hasn't gone perfectly well for them. So what do you think of that, folks? Jerry Salas yelled through the PA system, addressing the grandstand crowd. He calls the car every mutter's nightmare and comes from Logjam, name of Trent Smalls. And folks, the boy is only 17. Ollie watched as the tractor pulled the wrecked cars out of the ring. The station wagon that had done so much damage to the Impala had won the heat. And now to find out the driver was some punk kid from their town? Some kid half their age, almost like a version of themselves before they grew up, Coondog would be hot. The lights overhead burned, illuminating the busted cars in the ring. The open mouth of the grandstand looked dark, but Ollie knew it was chock full. The volunteer fireman driving the tractor left Coondog for last. When they finally looped the chain around the Impala's bumper and pulled it back into the ring, Coondog came squeezing out of the window of the welded shut door, orange helmet leading the way. Even from where he stood, Ollie could see it was the wrong thing to do. The fireman yelled at him and told him to stay the heck in his dang car. The tractor pulled the Impala back to their pit area, the chain jerking tight, sagging, and jerking tight again. The car's tires were still up, but the vehicle sat hunched down on its rear like the springs had collapsed. Out the window came Coondog, the ridiculous helmet still atop his neck like a melon on a broomstick. He clawed and jerked at its strap. "This damn thing," he screamed, his voice muffled by the mouthguard. He ripped the helmet off his head and threw it into the back seat, where it bounced and careened off the other door. "The car?" Ollie asked. "Hell yes, the car. What do you think I meant? I should have had enough power to get back over that shitting pole." He stared at the Impala, his face streaked with sweat and grime and the outline of the helmet's opening. He looked like he'd plugged a small pipe with his face until an explosion rifled out of it, singeing his eyebrows and sooting his cheeks. Suddenly, he slid back into the driver's seat. He cranked the ignition furiously. "Get in this shitbox," Coondog said. Ollie went around and climbed in through the window. He knew from experience a night like this sometimes ended in an arrest or a serious conversation with a person of some sort of local authority or renown. But he couldn't be expected to see everything coming as it happened. "Where's the seat belt on this death trap?" Ollie asked. "I took him out. Everything to make it lighter." "How much can a seatbelt weigh?" Coondog pumped the accelerator. The motor went up and down. Sitting in the car was like sitting near a gas fire, and the smell hung around them like curtains. Jerry Salas said something over the PA, but Ollie couldn't hear it. The heat had just ended, and a winner was being announced. The Impala bolted forward as Coondog dropped it into gear. He swung the wheel, and the car began to turn in a slow arc, like the turning of a big ocean-going ship. They drove down the rows of cars, some now completely junked, and others still being repaired. Coondog waved to some of the competitors. Others he drove by with hard stares. The car rolled with a gentle up and down motion, one of the wheels out of round. Ollie could feel the vibrations of the motor through his seat. They cruised toward the exit of the track. "Where are we going?" Ollie asked. I'm still not ready to give up on some split tail tonight, Coondog said, despite the fact that the demo did not turn out exactly as I planned it. He took a right at the road leading past the track and then another right at the first street in town, no license plate and one tail light. He turned into the main entrance of the fairground. The man in the booth next to the drive said they'd need to pay to park in the fairgrounds. He studied the car as he spoke. The engine sputtered like it might die. Entries to the demo should have come in off Orchard Road back by the track, the man said. He wore glasses and his eyes went two different directions. You couldn't tell which one you were supposed to look at. We done entered that, Coondog said. Then why are you over here, the man asked. A car pulled up behind the Impala, its headlights filling the cab. We done won it. Look, if you want to go to the fairgrounds, you should have walked over. No need to drive your car in here. Parking's tight enough as it is. We want to show it off. We want to show the people a winner. Another car pulled up in line, and the man grew visibly exasperated, his one eye focused intently on them. All right, I'll let you in, but no funny stuff in there. He motioned them on, and when Coondog let off the brake, the car jumped, and the engine almost died before it caught, and the Impala lunged forward into the fairgrounds proper. I never even had to pay him, he said, and they laughed. The parking lots were nothing but fields of gravel behind the different barns. They drove by the lot behind the sheep barn and then by the lot next to the hog barn. People stopped walking and stared at the car. Coondog honked like they were in a parade. Park this bitch, Ollie said. He was laughing his ass off, but enough was enough. Coondog steered the car down the main drag. Crowds of people clogged the road, causing him to slow down and making the engine sputter and choke. When they reached the end of the cattle building, he turned the car down a little path that was not meant for cars. A tractor hooked to a spreader stood there, parked so the 4-H kids could throw the crap from their steer, from their show animals, into the spreader. Someone on the fair board distributed the manure on a nearby field every day or so. I reckon we can park back here, he said. Ollie looked around. People were staring. A man dropped a length of rope and started walking toward them. It was dark, but bright lights mounted outside the barn revealed an open expanse dotted with trees standing over stock trailers. The 4-H'ers often slept in their trailers during the week. Coondog cut the wheel to the right to steer around the spreader. The tractor, Ollie noticed, was a John Deere 4030, just like the one his dad had owned. The headlights bounced across the open field, glinting here and there off the reflectors of the trailers. It looked muddy. Let's take this bastard car back here, Coondog said. This ain't no parking lot. My friend, Coondog said, you better put that helmet on. With that, he goosed the engine, and it sped up, almost died, then coughed and roared again. The back tire started to spin, and the Impala bounced out into the grass. Don't you dumbass, Ollie yelled, grabbing the door. The car bucked twice as it sped across the uneven ground, slinging mud in graceful arcs. Suddenly, it bogged down, lurched to a halt, and screwed itself noticeably lower into the earth. The back tires spun furiously, brown soup splattering against the wheel wells and quarter panels. Shit, it sure is wet back here, Coondog said. Against the sensation of the car slowly shifting back and forth and the sound of mud slapping metal came two things, the angry shouts of men and a powerful smell. Coondog floored it and the tires spun and sang falsetto against the mud. There was a sense of urgency to his actions now. He jerked the shifter back to reverse and floored it again. The car rocked back maybe a foot. When he shifted back into drive, the motor died. For a second or so, it was very quiet. Then men could be heard yelling, all of their voices blurred together, words like get and there and dumbass. Coondog stuck his head out the window. Against the light of the cattle barn, at least 10 people stood silhouetted, madly gesturing. Hey, he yelled, you all, I thought this was a parking lot. He laughed so hard he squealed. Ollie sat there looking back at the crowd. He wanted to laugh, but he couldn't. The smell was getting to him. Something rotten was seeping up through the floorboards. Coondog pulled back into the car and looked at him. I guess these pig suckers don't want you to park back here. They lifted out of their seats and climbed through the windows. When they dropped to the ground, they instantly sank up to the tops of their boots. The sour smell swelled and hit Ollie in the face, and he felt his stomach start heaving. Together, they staggered toward the men, jerking their feet free from the mud with each step. Ollie bit down on his tongue and fought the wretches. Waiting were the parents of the 4-H'ers who didn't like cars cutting donuts where their kids and expensive animals spent so much time. We better get ready to throw down, looks like, Coondog whispered. This time, don't leave me all the big fuckers. The group near the John Deere started hollering at once. A man with a mustache and a chest as wide as a door got in Coondog's face. What the hell were you boys doing back there? Wrong turn, Coon Dog yelled. We just won the demo and we come over here to celebrate. We got lost. Well, that car could just stay there, the man said. Another said something about it being stuck for life. Ollie looked at the men. He knew some of them. No one seemed to be a cop or a fireman, just fathers. One was the local veterinarian whose two boys showed beef cattle. Another man ran the bank. If they started swinging now, it would look like the town's two biggest roustabouts versus the city council. They'd end up in jail for sure. Maybe we could pick up trash around here tomorrow, Ollie said suddenly. The men all looked at him. We'll pick up trash for you all. Coondog looked over at him, eyes wide. He would have rather fought than suggest self-imposed community service. You boys better get on out of here before the sheriff shows up to ask questions, the man with the mustache said. Little kids were starting to gather, pointing at the car stuck out in the mud and the two men with brown slime up to their knees. One little boy pulled the arm of his dad. That's the mud hole where we dumped all that bad milk from the Breakfast of Champions, he said. Ollie looked at him and then down at his legs. He could feel the wetness soaking through to his skin. His boots were full of it, too. Milk cooking in the sun all day long. His stomach had never been that strong, and rotten food had always been his weakness. He bent deeply at the waist as he felt it rise up in his throat. He bit down and stopped it. He heaved again, and the puke burst forth from his mouth. It splattered on his boots, which reminded him of the milk, and he heaved again. The smell was everywhere now. He couldn't escape it. He puked again and again. He kept trying to walk away, but he couldn't walk and puke at the same time. What the hell, he heard Coondog say, now several steps removed. What the hell is wrong with you? He turned, still leaning over, and looked at the Impala. They'd fishtailed around when they'd hit the puddle, and now the car faced them, one good headlight still glowing weakly. It sat in mud up to the bottom of its doors. The bottom half of the wheels were completely hidden in gunk. Bend over, the car read. They've spray painted on it. He did just that, and another rope of vomit churned and fell from his mouth. When he finally finished puking, he stood up. Coondog had walked away over by the barn and was leaning against the fence, talking with some man, explaining how the mistake had been made. He gestured wildly with his hands. The man didn't seem impressed. Ollie looked the other way, toward the open area of the fairgrounds and the riders and carnival booths. People were walking by. The Ferris wheel, lit up with Christmas lights, went around and around. Groups of teenagers scampered by in packs. While he watched, a woman came into view. She was walking alone on the wood chip path, heading toward the horse barn. She didn't look his way. She didn't notice the car sunk in the mud. But from her profile, he could tell she was hot. Even with barf dribbling from his chin, he could tell she was the woman of his dreams. Oh, there she is, he whispered. Then, like a witness scrambling to note details of the getaway car, he memorized what he could. Jeans, white shirt, blonde hair just below her shoulders. A walk that said she knew where she was going, tonight and in life at large. The kind of woman he'd never had but always wanted. But she strolled on, completely oblivious to the demolition derby drama, reaching its denouement behind the tractor manure spreader, and he lost sight of her behind a small cluster of people waiting on the tilt-a-whirl. He'd have to go find her. Where the hell do you think you're going? Coondog stood alone near the tractor, his face still ringed from the helmet, his left arm muddy from having it hang out the car door as mud splattered. He was wearing a shirt that bore a picture of a Rottweiler. He didn't own dogs, but he'd put it on before the demo because he liked the symbolic message it carried. Man, I need to talk to her, Ollie said. A look of excitement darted across Coondog's face, and he started in his direction. Ollie put up both hands in a kind of panic. Let me talk to her, he said. You wait here by the car. Where the hell is that piece of shit going? Just hold on now. We don't want to spook her. I'll be right back. Ollie turned and jogged into the cattle barn. Coondog stood there and smiled, as if he had somehow managed to make all of this occur, which, of course, he had. So, that's an Indiana love story right there. So I've got one more. If you have it in you, I have one more piece I'd like to read, and then I'll take some questions and / party. This is from chapter 9, and we're back on the river, which is where the old man Frank and Chubb spend a lot of time, and they're almost there. He's actually at the farm at the beginning. By Sunday afternoon, it was raining again. This time it came gently over the woods to the west of them, descending slowly like a down blanket being laid over a sleeping child. The rain fell on the leaves of the trees, and each drop formed a soft rhythm, a million tiny heartbeats advancing through the woods. Frank cocked his ear to the open door of the barn and listened to its approach. They always got a lot of rain in July, thunderstorms mostly, but this summer felt more like a monsoon. He stood in the barn and watched the rain fall first on the garden, then the yard. It hammered the metal roof overhead. He'd been cleaning up the boat and was about ready to stop anyway. Now he'd get wet on the way to the house. He shut off the lights and grabbed a piece of plywood to serve as an umbrella. With his cane in one hand and the other holding the plywood over his head, he walked out into the rain. He looked down at the wet grass and remembered how he would gather night crawlers for bait on rainy nights when he was a kid. By the time he leaned the board against the house and shook off his hat, the phone was ringing. She answered it. "Oh, hi," she said. "Yes, he just got back in here. Looks like the rain drove him in." She lowered the receiver from her ear and stood there holding it out. Their only phone was attached to the kitchen wall. Its cord would not reach all the way to the mudroom. He leaned against the door jamb and untied his boots. Finally, he got to the kitchen, and she handed him the phone before swinging a chair out from under the table. He sat down, got the receiver positioned where he wanted it after considerable shuffling, and said, "This is Frank." "What do you know?" Chubb said. "Oh, not too much, I reckon. I went out and checked the fences this morning. River looks all right. Still high, though." "Funny you should say that. Guess what I was calling about?" "Fences?" "I don't give a damn about fences. No, I wanted to see if you'd noticed what it was doing outside." "Raining steady here." "That's what I figured. You know they're fixing to turn on something fierce when this rain hits them." Frank looked at his wife. She sat in the living room in her chair reading a paperback. "Not sure I'd want to get out too much past dark," he said. She looked up at him. "Be at my house in a few minutes?" "All right. All right, then." He hung up after waiting several seconds to see if Chubb was going to say anything additional. Eventually, he heard him hang up, so he did too. "Sounds like I'm going to be spending my Sunday evening by myself," she said. "How'd you know that?" "I know what you're up to. Can't you leave them fish alone for a day or two at least?" "Not with this rain, I guess. But he ain't got nothing better to do." She went to the window and looked out at the front yard, the driveway running out toward the road. A constant slow rain fell. "It's not going to storm, is it?" she asked. "Don't feel like it. We'll just be gone a couple of hours. Maybe we could do steaks when I get back." "Well, I might wait dinner on you, or maybe not." She sat back down with her book. He went to get his rain gear from the closet. He liked fishing in the rain. "Now, what do you suppose that son of a bitch is doing?" Chubb asked. He was peering downstream, hand over his eyes. He wore a poncho, and little rivulets ran down the plastic like streams down a mountainside. "I can't tell," Frank said, "but I thought I seen him throw something in. We better float down there and check it out." He turned the outboard so the bow cut its way into the main channel. The boat lightened and sped up with the faster water under it. They were heading downstream, and the current helped. They'd been out for an hour or so fishing. 6 decent channel cats were swimming in the live well. Chubb wanted to keep them to eat. Frank had hooked a fish in an eddy near a big pile of rocks that felt like it could have been a really good one. It might have been a big flathead. At first, the fish hadn't known it was hooked. Then it surged twice so hard the rod tip jerked into the water. Before he could turn it, the cat had gotten itself on the other side of a rock or sunken tree, and the line snapped. He kept thinking about it, how big it might have been, if it was a flathead or a giant channel, whether it would hit again if they stopped back by there. But now they'd come around this bend to find another boat near the far bank. As they got closer, they could see more. A man was standing in the little gray V-bottom, and occasionally he would reach down and pick something up and throw it out into the river. Then he would watch for a while, small splashings near the boat. He didn't have a pole in his hands and no rod tips poked over the gunwale, nor did he seem to be running limb lines or nets. They rarely saw another boat out here most days anyway, but this one was up to something. Frank turned his boat toward the man. Chubb sat in the front, and Frank had to raise partially off his seat to see over him. The tiller was wet in his hands, and still rain fell. When they got near the other boat, Frank put the motor in neutral and let the current drift them downstream. The man watched them come and sat down, the small boat rocking. He stared at them, eyes hard. Dripping black hair, long like a lion's mane, hung around his neck. He was almost bald up top. "Howdy," Chubb called. The man raised his hand a little. He was shirtless, and his nipples and chest sagged like he wore borrowed skin from someone bigger, and you about expected to see a zipper running up the back. There were dark blotches on the chest that must have been tattoos, all this wet from the rain, his blanched skin waterlogged. An anchor line came off the stern of his little metal boat, the current piling and pushing and pointing the bow downstream. "You catching any fish?" Chubb asked him. "Oh, I ain't fishing," the man called. His voice sounded high-pitched and off. "We seen you throwing something in the water. Thought maybe you had a new way of fishing," Chubb said. He laughed a little like he'd shared some kind of joke. Raindrops dimpled the river's surface. "Huh? Nah, hell, I ain't fishing. I just got too many damn pups." "You got too many what?" Frank asked. "Pups. An old bitch dog of mine dropped about 10 pups. She ain't got enough milk for 'em. That, and I ain't feeding them all." Frank looked downstream, not sure if he'd heard correctly. He could see nothing, only the ripples made by the slow current and the occasional log or limb sticking out of the water. He put the outboard in reverse to keep them near the man. He pushed the hood of his rain suit back off his hat so his ears were exposed. "What did you say you was doing?" he yelled. "You old son bitches are hard of hearing or something. I told you, I've been throwing out some pups. Not that it's any of y'all's business." "You're just throwing them in the water," Chubb said. "Hell yes, cheapest way to get rid of them." "What the hell's wrong with you?" Frank asked. The man looked from Chubb back to Frank. Maybe 12 feet separated the two boats. His eyes went crazy, white showing all around the colored centers. "What the shit you care? This ain't your river." "Some of it is," Frank said. "I own a piece down that ways." "Good for you, asshole. What do I care what you own?" Frank kept the outboard idling in reverse, trying to keep abreast of the boat without getting too close or too far from it. Chubb turned around and looked at him. Frank could tell he was ready to leave this crazy son of a bitch be. He was not yet ready himself. "You don't have to," Frank said. "I just think it's a cowardly man that'll drown pups in a damn river." The man stood up violently, his boat tipping and nearly throwing him overboard. He was wearing cut-off jean shorts worn to the threads. His entire person was stained black with oil or dirt. "Oh, yeah? Well, watch this, motherfucker," he yelled. He bent down and hoisted something off the floor of the boat. What he came up with was no bigger than a sack of sugar. It was yellow and squirming. He gripped it by its back legs, and it cried out. "Let's see this little fucker take his swimming lesson," he said, and swung the animal out toward Chubb. It hit the water about halfway between the two boats and sank. "You're the motherfucker, you know that?" Chubb shouted. The man flipped him off with dirty fingers. "Get out of here, you old bastard," he yelled, waving his arms. "Get on and get fishing. Leave me the hell alone." But Frank watched where the dog splashed down, and he saw its head resurface briefly, a snout pointed skyward, just the mouth and nose coming back to air, feet churning under the foam. The man saw him looking and looked there himself. "That little bastard already knows how to swim," he laughed. "Well, let him swim on the shore then." The dog went back under. Frank turned around and put the motor in gear. "Get the net," he said to Chubb. "Oh, you're going to save him, are you? Well, wait, because I got one more." The man reached down and grabbed at something, missed it, took a step in the shaky boat and grabbed again. Again, he held the pup by its hind legs and tail, and it yelped in pain and surprise. "Last one," he said, offering it up like a fish in the rain. Before Frank could speak, the man whipped and swung the dog hard against the gunwale. It cracked, a sound like the swinging of a stick of fire wood against the metal boat side. He dropped the body into the river, watching Frank. The pup hit the water, already dying or dead. The two men stared at each other, the man's eyes wide and white. Frank twisted the throttle and moved quickly downriver. He pushed the tiller a little to the right and kept his eyes on the water. The river narrowed just past where the boat had been anchored, sweeping into a bend. The current ran faster here. "Where'd that dog go?" he asked, barely able to maintain his voice. Chubb looked at him and then back to the river. "I think it's long gone," he said. Frank didn't know how far downstream to look, how quickly the current would take the pup away. But then something just ahead caught his eye, a piece of driftwood no bigger than a muskrat. He turned toward it slightly, careful not to run too close and risk overtaking it with the bow. His eyes had focused on the river and its currents for so many nights and days he knew how to read it. He saw the slight ripples undulating from that piece of driftwood. It was swimming. net right there, he said, pointing. Chubb saw two and held the big catfish net over the side of the boat as they approached. The pup could barely move its paws, paddling instinctually against the current. It had lost that fight and was being pushed in small circles. Its tail flowed behind it, a useless rudder. The brown nose sucked and sputtered at the surface. Frank looked down and saw the whites of the dog's eyes peering upward from under the water. Then, with one fluid stroke, Chubb swooped the net forward and down before swinging it aboard, just as he had 1,000 times with hooked fish. In the space between them, on the rib floor of the John boat, he lowered the net. It was hard to see what he had through the folds of the mesh, but Frank put the motor in neutral and crouched forward, on his hands and knees now, pushing aside and untangling the net. The dog looked as dark as wet cardboard. It whimpered and paddled its feet. It was wild-eyed and frantic, the whites of its eyes still showing around the dark circles of its irises, not unlike those of the man who had thrown it. It scratched against the net and Frank's hands. Finally, he had it clear, and he scooped the pup against his stomach and cradled it to his rain suit. He held the feet so it couldn't struggle. Still, it cried out and coughed and gagged. He unzipped his jacket and pressed the dog to his shirt. He could feel the river water soaking through and the wild beating of its heart. "Hey, we're about to hit," Chubb said. They had drifted with the current against the far bank, and now overhanging limbs raked across the boat. With one hand, Frank reached back and flipped the outboard into reverse before giving it gas. The boat pulled back into the main channel. "Let's go sink that asshole," Chubb said. They had drifted around the bend, the other boat no longer visible. "I sure as hell want to, but let's look for more of them dogs first." Chubb shrugged. "If you think any's still alive." In the rain, they continued downstream then, Frank instructing him to look here and there as he spotted things that could have been pups. Eventually, they found some, but they were all dead and floating, their bodies caught against log jams or in eddies, spinning slowly and silently in the current, pink bellies rolling up with lifeless paws. When they finally gave up and returned to find the man, he was gone. "You ever seen him before?" Frank asked. Chubb said he had not. "Well, he must live around here somewheres." The men rowed along silently, now growing against the current upstream. Frank held the dog against his body. It hadn't stopped crying. "You reckon we'll ever see him again?" Chubb asked. "If we do, he better know how to catch bullets with his teeth. I hate to see a bastard be mean to them powerless animals." Frank said nothing, only felt the heat rising in him again. "You gonna keep that dog?" Chubb asked. "You want him?" "No, I don't want no dog." Frank looked down at the pup. It was shivering, face pushed down into the fold of his shirt. He could feel its ribs under its wet hair. "I'll keep him for a while," he said. "I reckon you got to keep a dog like this, born to already knowing how to swim." And so they motored back to the truck like that, going slowly to avoid ripping out the propeller on a deadhead or rock, Chubb sitting in the bow, the catfish still thumping against the sides of the live well, and Frank steering the motor with one hand and holding the pup with the other. A light rain fell on everything. Well, thank you all so much for coming out, and thanks to the Tattered Cover and to Kent, and just thank you. It's an absolute highlight of my career. It's all downhill from here. This is it. Thank you, thank you.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Authors on Tour Live has been presented by Belco Credit Union. Belco has been serving members' financial needs since 1936. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks for many more authors as we podcast Authors on Tour.